Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let's go to the punk rock show. Darling, take me by the hand. We're gonna say a punk rock band. There's no use in TV shows, radio, rodeo. Wanna get into the crowd and I wanna hear it play real loud. We got no place to go, so let's go to the punk rock show. Darling, take me by the hand. We're gonna see a punk rock band. There's no use in TV shows, radio, rodeo. I wanna get into the crowd, I wanna hear it play real loud.
Dude.
Hey, what's up? Sorry, yeah, I just had to push a button or something.
How are you?
I'm good. Can you hear me loud and clear?
Yeah, I'm just...
All right.
Go again.
Hey, hey, hey. Check
weird.
One, two.
You're coming out of... I know why it is. And in process this, my friends. Yeah, I've just got to... And again now?
Yep.
There we go. I had the mic going through the headphones, but the laptop and your sound just coming out the laptop, so...
Oh, yeah.
It's an absolute total minefield for me. Like, I'm so used to doing these in person. And, you know, we'll get to talking about it because obviously you do your own podcast as well. But, well, first of all, it's amazing to finally get you on the show, man. Like, we've done a bunch of tours together, bunch of festivals together, and it's always been on the cards. But, I mean, maybe you can tell me your thoughts on this, but for me, being on tour is like a double-edged sword when it comes to podcasting. Obviously people are there and so the access is there, but I've found that, you know, obviously space backstage is fairly minimum, especially on the kind of tours that we've been on together where it's like a multiple band bill. Sound obviously isn't great. You've got to lug your gear around, you know, it might just be a couple of mics, but whatever it is. So yeah, but then the other side, and I think the best thing about recording podcasts on tour for me is you get to connect, especially if you do it at the start of tour, you get to connect with the person that you're touring with and break down those, you know, initial social barriers. And we've never gotten to do that. So I'm hoping that in the course of actually our chat today, we can properly connect for the first time. It's always just been like peripheral hangs, but this is great. But yeah, do you do much podcasting on the road, Mike?
By the way, thanks for having me on.
you know, hit the ground running.
I always have that idea, you know, you describing that brings back a lot of ideas and a lot of memories, and I have the idea to do a lot of podcasting, but you're right, it's hard to find a quiet room, a quiet space, a private space where people aren't coming in and out of, even if it's quiet. Usually you're on sometimes like on a tour bus where crew and band is coming in and out and everybody's, hey, 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 which is fun too, you know, depending on the style of podcast you're trying to do. But I think the idea of podcasting on tour is much better than actually doing it. And I agree with you completely. Like, podcasting is great for breaking down those barriers, breaking the ice, asking people that you, even people you're friends with, you know, cause I do a lot of podcasting with friends of mine that are in bands. And you just don't feel comfortable asking them some questions that are all of a sudden kind of okay to do if you're on a podcast, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, those barriers are great to break down. As far as like the realistic thing you're talking about, just sometimes headspace isn't there for an artist to sit down for an hour when they're on tour, when they maybe you're thinking about, you know, the show the night, you know, that night or whatever it is. So sometimes it's hard right when tour starts. You know, once you get into a rhythm, I feel like, okay, now that's usually when I'll ask somebody, hey, can you do a podcast or whatever? But it's tough, man. It's really hard to do. And obviously you're coming out, you're seeing bands on the road, traveling through. Are you in London, like, or the London area?
I left about 3 months into this whole COVID thing. I was down, okay. And you know, everything was going great. Had like some residencies in London, was DJing every weekend, you know, making an all right living. And then it hit, and I did a couple of months where I was like scringing and scraping and, you know, just about getting by. And when I realized it was going to be longer than a couple of months, because I think originally everybody thought, oh, this will be over and done with soon, right? When I realized it was sticking around, I just made the decision to get out, because I was paying London prices to be there in this city where everything was closed and there was really no point in being in London, you know, because I can now do what I do, which is only this. There's no DJing at the moment. So
yeah,
these podcast conversations can now occur anywhere. So I'm in Birmingham, where I originally grew up and where I'm from. I've sort of returned. I'm actually in my like old familial, you know, childhood home. And that's been its own, you know, process, which I'm sure we'll get to. But yeah, I was in London, but had to get out.
It makes sense, though. I mean, everybody's kind of having to adjust, convert, figure out, okay, this is the world right now. So if anything, it's just part of this crazy life we live. You know, it's always something. It just happens to be this right now, right?
Yeah. So. Well, what you mentioned about touring as well, before I toured properly, and this is something that I think, because, you know, your podcast is super unique and interesting for me, because I think you were one of the first musicians to start one. Now there's a few more, but you're definitely the first like musician podcaster that I've had on my show. There's been people who've been on in the past who now have a podcast, like Matt from the Bronx has started one in lockdown with Sailor Jerry. Chris from Less Than Jake, I know, has one now, but he didn't when I had him on. But you've been doing yours a fair old while, so you must have been one of the first to start one. And even now, there's still like nowhere near, I don't think, enough musicians doing them. If you look at comedians, right, podcasting is a way of engaging with your fan base all the time. It's a way of promoting what you're up to, so you can almost cut out the press and the middleman. You know, you can like do so many of the business pros, you know, you can network in a way that's not gross because you can just generally connect with people, and you know, that might then lead to a future tour, whatever. It's such a self-serving, brilliant thing, I think, for musicians, but so few still do them. But I come at obviously from a perspective more of a journalist point of view, but then I've also been on a lot of tours as well. So I kind of like can combine those two worlds. So my perspective's unique as well. But when I hear people on your show, you know, it's evidently two musicians talking to each other rather than, you know, even if I have a good conversation and we really connect, it's still a slightly different perspective. And that's not, you know, bad or better. It's just different, right? But yours right. is very much, you know, the world, so you can connect in that way. And I kind of have one foot in both, so I can kind of, you know, try and combine the two. But touring is a tiresome, although very fun and rewarding, it's an intense environment, isn't it? And you mentioned the word headspace. That's the key thing there. It's so hard trying to get normal things done. Like, I don't think you could easily carry out a role that you normally do when you're at home on tour, you know, whether that's admin or creative. I mean, do you write on the road? Do you record on the road? Do you do any of
sure.
the songwriting side of things?
That's a great question. I used to. I think as the world has gotten busier and crazier, I compartmentalize those things better and more than I used to. Back when we were touring pretty constantly, we, you know, there would be a fall tour, a winter tour, spring tour, summer, everything. There was always a tour, right?
Yeah.
Then I would write on tour. I would go into the back of the bus and just, if somebody wasn't playing video games, I go back there and write. And that, you know, anytime nowadays that I need to write, it's a headspace. Like you were just saying, like I have to get into a routine. So when you're on tour, you get into the routine of being on tour, and there are certain things you can do, and everybody's a little different. Somebody like Chris DeMakes, he's got so much energy. You know, he probably gets a million things done every day.
And the thing with Chris is he's one of the few guys that's at, because I DJ all the after parties on a lot of these tours, right? As you've seen and you know, Chris is the one guy that is always there at every single after party every night. So the energy just never stops. Like he can be up till the crack of dawn hanging out at the after show. And then the next day he's like, that was awesome. Last night was great. Let's go. You know, and he's seemingly never tired. I don't know what his secret is. And it definitely isn't anything naughty.
Right. No, yeah. I don't know what the secret is, but we're going to find it eventually. We're going to get it from him.
What's your secret, yeah, Chris? It must just be enthusiasm, right?
I mean,
it must be that.
It's just everybody's different. You know, I look at old interviews of myself and I'm like, man, wake up, dude. Nobody told me to pay attention and to like be enthusiastic about what I'm talking about. And it's just funny how you learn these things over time and over just, you know, seeing yourself. But as far as touring and the headspace, you know, everybody's a little different. So I just love the podcast part of it. Nowadays, every now and then, yes, I'll get a podcast on tour where I'll sit down with somebody we're playing with, or even a band member, you know, one of my band members. I always kind of feel bad asking them, like, come on, sit down, let's do this, you know, and they've been on over and over and over, but it's always a new conversation. That's the thing is, you know, you were saying you can connect with people for the first time, but you can rekindle that every time. Like every time you do a podcast with somebody, you know, you feel a little bit more comfortable and it's that much more authentic, I think. So,
yeah, man, I've, you know, gotten so much out of doing this show. I mean, I'm about 210 episodes deep as we speak. You're about 350. So you've been going for ages, man, but so many relationships have come out of it and I haven't forced it. And it's never been like in a gross way that I'm chasing it, but it kind of stands to reason, right? That if you do sit down for a length of time with someone, whether you know them before or not, and you, as you say, in this context, you kind of maybe have a bit more of a carte blanche to ask slightly more, not invasive, but, you know, revealing personal questions than you might in a just chit chat conversation because of the confines. Well, not the confines, because of the context of what this is. You can kind of fast track relationships sometimes. It's almost like speed dating, but in a, you know, a platonic way. I've been going down the rabbit hole with your show in the lead up to this chat and just really, I mean, there's a couple that I want to ask you about in specific detail, but first of all, I'd love to know, Mike, what was the inspiration for starting it? Because you were one of the first and you must have been going now 6 years, 7 years?
Yeah, 2013, I think, was when I put my first podcast out. And I'd been thinking about doing it. Everybody thinks about doing it for a while and they're just like, Should I, you know, does anybody care, whatever. And that's the thing is I was listening to podcasts. I was loving the idea of people, you know, just getting to know people from listening to them. And so my idea was, okay, this is a great way for people that haven't been, you know, people that hadn't been paying attention to what we were doing. Let's get them back into the mix. And at the same time, I can talk to all my friends. I can talk to new people, meet new people. And as a band guy, some people are really outgoing and other band people are a little standoffish. And it's not that they don't want to talk to people. It's just, it's one, having that idea that, okay, I don't want to waste somebody's time, you know, because I know how it feels to have somebody constantly talking to you or whatever. And so like that almost made me not do it in a way. I'm like, I don't want to like constantly bother people. But once I did it, you know, it was just, it's a freeing feeling, you know, being able to just talk to somebody. Maybe it's like almost like therapy, you know, talk therapy in a way, not in a medical way, but just talking to your friends, you know, during the whole pandemic, you know, when people have been locked down, if we didn't have something like Zoom or FaceTime or things like this to like connect with our friends. Can you imagine that? So like, I think the podcast just does that on a underlying scale. And it's not like I thought about that really when I started the podcast, but it's something that definitely has been a huge upside is just connecting to people. Like you said, connecting, that's it. And if there's anybody out there listening, like I listen to podcasts, and I listen to all types of podcasts, but if I listen to a podcast kind of like mine, where it's a conversation, it could go anywhere. It doesn't have to just stay on, we're talking about medical examinations and we're going to stick to this. But I feel like if anybody, when I listen to the podcast like that, I feel like, oh, I'm one of the people in the room just listening. I'm just not able to talk back. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do with the podcast. Trying to forget that the podcast is there in some ways, but it gets tough sometimes. I mean, do you ever wonder about, should I be this open with my guests, but not only with my guests, should I be this open with the world? Not that the world is listening, but there's a lot of people out there listening. So do you ever think about that, Matt?
Yeah, all the time. Well, in fact, no, I used to. And then I made a conscious choice early on that I was just, and it might have been actually what led to the downfall of my previous relationship, I think. But when I started this show, I was in a relationship, and I remember there was a couple of episodes early on. Mental health and depression is a big subject for me. It's something that is very close to my heart and my home. You know, my mom's bipolar. I've had real struggles over more in the last sort of 5, 6, 7 years than in my earlier life, but it's come to the forefront in my 30s, really. And so when I started this show, I wanted to use my platform to have open discussions about these kind of topics. And I definitely sensed early on my ex-partner was like super awkward about me talking about these kind of things on a very, as you say, public platform. It's not that the whole world is checking out my show, but anybody could. And but what I found, man, was that not only do you get more out of the guest if you open yourself, it's not that you're hijacking the conversation, but if you go, look, this is a trust exercise, and if you're going to trust me, then I'm going to tell you some stuff about me too, so it's not a one-way street. You get better conversations that way, but also the people listening, because this isn't just a self-indulgent conversation between two people. The hope is that anybody out there who can, you know, connect or relate to certain topics will feel better about their life and themselves. You know, they might sound like grand ideas, but I go into my show with those things in mind. And I do feel like if you're open and honest in such a fearless and upfront way, then, you know, people, that's what people connect and relate to. It's the same thing with music, right? If there's heart there and people can hear it, they can hear authenticity and sincerity, that's going to endear that show, that person, that band to the listener a hell of a lot more than people who are just going through the motions, right? And almost being a bit standoffish. But then not everybody is that open. You just got to be true to you, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you? I mean, that's the thing with podcasting. There's so many different styles of podcasting. Some are very much pre-written, you know, and then you just read your script, which is fine. You know, it's like, that's a style. And like I said, with this kind of podcasting, it's really just about getting your memory jogged a lot of times, because I don't like to come into a podcast. Like if I'm doing a podcast, sure, I'll have some ideas that I want to ask my guests. But if I'm going on a podcast like yours, I don't necessarily want to have like pre stories and like things like that. But when you say something, it could jog a memory, and then boom, we're off to the races. So like, I love those kind of conversations, you know? And like I said, there's so many different styles, but you know, you find what you like, and you get people that probably listen to every single episode that, you know, of Life in the Stock. So, I mean, that's great. And those are the people, that's the reason why you do the show, of course, aside from personal reasons.
Yeah. You mentioned something a moment ago as well, like, and that resonated with me. And I think the reason that podcasts work so well, and there's a punk rock element to this medium and this format as well, because there's no restrictions, there's no restraints. It's not like commercial radio or print where there's a word limit or you have to go to the ads at a certain point. It's so free. It's so DIY. You can talk about whatever you want with whoever you want. And, you know, I've done everything. I've done TV, I've done radio, I've done magazines, I've done online. I've worked for all the major companies and done every form of media. And as soon as I started doing this particular form, I was like, this is me, because this is who I am. And it is about that just deep rooted conversation, because for me, there is nothing more. It's the greatest natural and legal, I think, high you can get. I think like a deep, profound conversation with someone can bring you out of a hangover or a slump of depression or any kind of like negative emotion you might be carrying, the right conversation with the right person, I think, can lift all that, like, you know, the clouds just gone, and it can really change your, you know, whole mood and outlook for the entire day and beyond. You must have had that in times in your podcasting journey, right, where the conversations have ran so deep that they've almost changed your life in a way.
Oh yeah, that's happened for sure. And you know, I'll be talking to like my manager or something like that and be like, oh yeah, this podcast, you know, I just talked to so-and-so and they said this, and it was like, I can't stop thinking about it. Like, that's actually happened fairly recently too on some of the recent podcasts. But yeah, that's the best. I mean, that's why we talk to people, to learn, have new ideas, get a different perspective. And I'm classic at not seeing the other angles. You know, if I have an idea about anything, really, this is a great idea. Okay. It's a hot air balloon. And a throwing knife show at the same time, you know, whatever, I don't know. So yeah, but aren't the knives going to pop the balloon? Like, I didn't think of that part.
Oh yeah, you know, yeah. So. Of course. Why wouldn't I see that? Yeah. Perspective is everything, right? Everything.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's great about, another great thing, since we're making this theme of a podcast, at least so far, talking to another artist, another songwriter, for me is great, because it's not that I want to do what they do necessarily, but I want to ask, okay, what's your process? You know, when you're writing a song, what comes first? What do you find hardest, lyrics or melodies or, you know, instrumentation, you know, all that stuff, is because I'm going through it all the time. And I've been through all these different layers of joy and frustration, right? And so when you find somebody else that has those same experiences, you want to hear, were they the same as mine? Were they different? They're usually some similar. Like a lot of people used to write in notebooks, and nowadays they're writing on their cell phone, right? And in their notes on their phone. And I do the same thing, even though, like, I wish I could just write it in, but I edit so much nowadays that if I write it down, I'm constantly scribbling it out. And it's just like these little details I love to find out about my friends and about, you know, artists that I love. I just had Noodles on, and he was talking about how they find their guitar tones and they go crazy.
I listened to it. I loved it.
Oh, right on. Thank you.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
And I love hearing, like, okay, so you go into the studio with The Offspring, you know, they've got Bob Rock producing, which he's done a million great albums. And he just goes through all these guitar tones, goes way too far. And then they pick the best stuff, and then they filter out all the craziness, all the stuff that's, we don't need all that. But like, in the same way they do that is kind of how I write bass lines sometimes. Like, I'll write too much and I'll just be noodling, and then I'll pare it down to, okay, what can I actually pull off consistently? And then what's going to sound good for the song, and all these questions, you know, get answered as you go. But I just love that. So, I mean, podcasting, I wouldn't necessarily just call up Noodles. I mean, we're friends, but I don't talk to him daily and be like, hey, so what's up with that guitar tone? Like, how do you get that? There's a couple people I could do that too, but overall, it's just, you don't have enough time in the day.
Well, what you're mentioning there throws back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, when a musician hosts a podcast, you're going to get a different conversation than a journalist, you know. And I try and always ask questions that aren't typical, and I try and more like stimulate talking points than actually ask direct questions anyway. But when you get to listen to a guy like you, who's a musician and a songwriter, talk to another musician and songwriter, you're going to get insights that you wouldn't get, you know, from hearing that person being interviewed by a magazine or a radio station, because it's a guy who doesn't know about the process. And that's why I absolutely love it, and encourage, if there's any musicians listening to this, start a podcast. Like, it'll be the best thing you ever do. And there's more people doing it this year, because obviously we've had a lot more time on our hands, and it's great to see. But I definitely like to see a lot more. Toby Morse has started one, and I mean, his guest list, I don't know if you follow him or see who he gets on his show, but he's getting like Michael Rapaport and Juliet Lewis.
He's right there in LA, and they all just come by. It's great. That's another thing is sometimes people don't necessarily want to do a video interview, but they'll come by for like an in-person interview because everybody's different, like I said. But with podcasting, going back to that a little bit, it's interesting because when you talk to somebody for so long, it breaks down those barriers. It breaks down any kind of facade you know, there's really good actors that could just keep it, you know, keep it going and going and going. But usually, you know, if you hear a podcast with a politician, if it's really short sound bites, they sound like they're full of shit.
Yep.
But if it's a longer conversation, like a podcast, all of a sudden you're like, okay, I always hated this person, but they actually sound reasonable. And I can understand a little bit why they think this. I still disagree with this point and this point, but like, you start to become a human in a lot of ways. And maybe that's why more band guys don't do podcasts, because you can't keep that facade up. You can't keep that image up. You're going to be silly. You're going to say the wrong thing. And luckily with MXPX, sure, we have an image or whatever, but like, we've always been very DIY, very kind of just like, let's go do this ourselves. Let's help out our friend. But whatever. You know, so it works. It works for me. My
your
image, if you
mail orders, right? Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, my mom just does our mail.
It doesn't get more DIY than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And she'll like, we do. Sometimes we'll have lyric sheets in the store where people can order actual custom sheets for a song that we do, and I'll do it. My mom sends me a text with a screenshot, like, here's the order you got to do. And so I'll be, all right, I'll get that to you. And so later today, I'll be dropping off a lyric sheet to my mom at the merch arsenal, we call it.
Amazing.
Yeah, you're pretty insane.
You're exactly right, man. And the thing is like, I find the most of the gold, unless you hit the ground running, which some podcasts, you know, can do. For instance, your amazing chat with Ben Weasel, who we'll get to in a moment. But I find often the gold is about 45 minutes in. You know, if you're going to chat for like an hour to 90 minutes, I always find it stacked towards the back end of that conversation that the real gold is happening, because people are relaxed and the conversation's flowing freely. And again, it's such a refreshing alternative to this bite-sized clickbaity world that we're now in. You know, journalism and the media these days, and you'll have seen the change in your career with the advent and rise of the internet and social media, and it's now all about that newsworthy clickbaity headline, isn't it? And just the one quote taken out of context, and these are all the things now which seem to like rise to the surface and occupy people's attention. But there's obviously, as the, you know, the fastest growing medium that podcasting is, there's still this hunger and want for long form conversation without agenda, you know, without angles, and it's just about two people connecting. And because podcasts are so popular now, it goes to show that in this world of rapid information and disposable content, and I hate that word, the soul is still there, isn't it? People do still want and crave like the analog conversation.
Yeah, I mean, podcasts are built for a different audience than maybe top 40 radio playlist podcasts would be, you know, where it's kind of like the MTV style show where they used to just, you know, you have a VJ talk, interview, half of a video, another half of a video from another artist or whatever, and then back to the conversation. Like, that's a style, right? And those are made for mass audiences. They're not made for maybe they're made to touch people's hearts in different ways, but yeah, with podcasting, with regular long form conversations, it really is meant for just the individual. Everybody connects, and it's funny, you know, like a podcast like Joe Rogan is huge, you know, and he did the huge deal with Spotify, and everybody thinks, okay, podcast now is, you know, we can make money on podcasting, and now that's why we're going to do it. So, I mean, you have all these things, and I don't do podcasting because I'm a podcaster and I love podcasting. Like, it's just literally a cool form of connecting with people. Like, we've been talking about that word connect a lot, but it really is. And in a way, I think I finally found it, because artists are so, they act very outgoing a lot of times, but if you're a songwriter, you're in your head a lot, and you're thinking about, okay, this idea and this idea, and I'm just like sitting there by myself. And sure, we have this phone that we can connect to other people in the world, but I'll just put that down and just focus on songs. And, you know, as an artist, you're going to be different as a song, I think, doing a podcast than if you're somebody out there that's just looking for whatever the next big thing is to do to get your project out there. And there's nothing wrong with getting your project out there. Like I love to actually bring people on that need help, bring smaller bands on, bring artists on that my audience definitely doesn't know about, or a few people may. But that's the thing, is like, we're all in these bubbles, right? And it's like, how do we break out of these internet bubbles? And all it is I think collaboration and just keep going. So like you were talking about, it's all about the headlines and the splash, and it is in a lot of ways, but I feel like consistency, playing that long game, as a podcaster, like, sure, you know, it's something that's going to be a lot of work for a lot of years, but it's for a greater purpose, I feel like. And it's not, I'm not just podcasting just a podcast. Like you said, I'm there to connect with my audience every week. And if there's nothing new that I'm doing, well, at least I can showcase what my guest is doing. There's always something new that I'm doing. I just may not want to talk about it yet, but you know,
well,
that's the beauty of it.
You guys have been extremely prolific over the years. You know, there's always been a record every 2 to 3 years since you started. And you know, I think that's a very, to keep it fresh and exciting, and to continue to be inspired, is a great thing. Cause I think you can see it when artists aren't, you know, whether that's that they disappear for a bit and you kind of go, okay, like The Offspring is a great example. You know, 9 years without an album. That's clearly because in that time they weren't inspired. And it must be hard to be inspired when you're the fucking Offspring, because you've had these hits, which are so gigantically huge, and you have to then live in the shadow of that, like a pretty fly for a white guy. Right. Whereas,
yeah, I would love to talk about this whole in a broader way sense, but, it takes time. It's like percolating ideas. Sometimes you'll have a song idea and you bring it to the band and we play through it and it just doesn't sound like you thought it would. I mean, there's all different reasons why bands don't do albums quicker, don't get inspired as soon. A lot of it, I would say, Offspring were on tour probably a lot, doing festivals. Every summer they go to Europe, do festivals over there. They're doing North America, probably doing South America too. Let's pretend that the pandemic doesn't exist, but that's one thing. I mean, you probably remember Noodles actually said they don't record on tour. They don't really write on tour. They just tour. When they're touring, they're drinking beer, they're having a good time, they're focusing on the task at hand. And I think this, a lot of people are like that. So touring is one big chunk. It's like, okay, touring takes away from a new album. Not everybody's like Laura Jane Grace. She is prolific and probably writes constantly, like every day, even on tour, but not everybody's like that. And I'm sure she would even say that there's plenty that she's not getting done. But so there's the touring thing, the ideas, and even just being ready. Like if you write a bunch of songs, chances are you're going to want to take a break from that style. Like it's almost like you need your ideas to fill back up in your head. And it's a weird,
it's the creative well, right? That's why they call it that.
Yeah, kind of. And it's not writer's block at all. I think it's just, man, right now, every riff I write is the exact same riff. And it's annoying to me as a songwriter. That's what happens. Like things like that. Or I keep writing about the same kind of thing. I can only think of these five words and I just rearrange them in different ways. Like that to me says, I just need to chill and do other things, you know? And it's usually when it's like, when we're rehearsing for the live on the internet shows we do for MXPX, we're relearning old songs that sometimes we've never played live. Most times we haven't played in a long time. If we had played it live, like all these different things. And so I got to go back, relearn bass lines, relearn lyrics, print out all the lyrics, type out all the lyrics, figure out a set list, all these things that go into doing a set that's different from your normal kind of greatest hit style set that a lot of people do. We know all those songs in our sleep, you know, the favorites, but
that must be, as a quick side note, one of the few nice things about the pandemic is the live stream shows. I guess you get to dust off material, which you wouldn't probably traditionally play out on tour. And it does it free you in that sense to be a little bit more experimental with the shows and the set list?
Yeah. So, I mean, our show, we call it Between This World and the Next because it's a show. It's a live band playing a show, but it's not at a venue. It's in our rehearsal space. So it looks a little different, more intimate. And then because we're doing B-sides, deep cuts, some covers now and again that we've never done, things like that, it really is freeing, to answer your question. And it's also been a challenge. It's been a really cool something to focus on. It made the pandemic, you know, last year go by really fast because we were on this sort of schedule where it was 2 or 3 weeks between live shows. And we had that next set list. It was a completely new set list. We maybe did 1 or 2 songs again. You know, we always do Let's Write at the end. We have a new song out April 16th called Can't Keep Waiting that we actually started playing live on the internet without it being out or recorded. So like, if somebody bootlegs it, whatever, I'll just write another song. But so that's finally
coming
out.
That's a great attitude, man. I love that attitude. We'll just do another one.
Yeah, just do another one. I mean, we as artists, I mean, I'm going to say we, because most artists are very precious about the songs they write, about the art they create, whatever it is they create. And I've been guilty of that with my songs. And at the end of the day, it's a punk song. It's not, it's better if people hear it, and that's it. That's all that matters, really. But so yeah, Can't Keep Waiting. That was fun. So Between This World and the Next and doing all these deep cuts has been a challenge. That's really been great mentally to the whole band comes together and we're like, oh yeah, we need more work on this. And we'll just go through those, you know, group of songs that we're really bad at. We're just like, this is going to be painful. And if we're not, we don't quite have a song by the time the show hits, we'll just switch that out with one we know better. But that's part of the joy of it, is like fans that have seen some of the, you know, a bunch of the shows, some fans see every show, they get it. They're wondering, okay, what's coming next? And then they're also realizing that every now and then something gets screwed up or could get screwed up because it is live. We're not recording and then airing it live, or, you know, live or whatever in quotations. It's all live. And that's the thing, is because we have our own studio here, we have the ability to leave everything kind of set. And it, you know, what's funny about that too, is people don't realize this. If you set up a recording, a studio, whatever it is, and you leave it for a day or two, you leave it for a week, a month, whatever the time is, the more time that passes, usually the more different it's going to sound, and things change electronically. And you would think, oh, if you just leave it, no one touched it, it should sound exactly the same, but you'll come back to
ghosts
things.
Ghosts in the machine, isn't it?
Ghosts. There's always ghosts in the machine. So that's a little bit of a tangent, but
no.
A very true thing that happens. So like when bands sound check for a show during the day at a club, whatever venue, that's why they sound check again really quick before they go on. Like you'll hear, doo, doo, can I get kick? Doo, 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 snare, pop, pop, pop. Because a lot of times you'll have a microphone line that's gone dead in between, you know, just 4 hours, 5 hours when you did that sound check. You're like, it worked. It sounded great for sound check. What happened?
Yeah, these inexplainable things, man. And that's kind of right there, the beauty of all of this. I find it inexplainable, you know, because if everybody knew how to recreate that one hit that they had all those years ago, right? If they could just shit out hits all the time, if it was that easy, if it was that scientific, everybody would be successful. Every album would be full of hits, right? But it's not. You can't really distill what it is that makes a song popular or where the inspiration comes from or any of these things, right? It's eternally just the chasing and the trying to capture and bottle what I do believe to be magic. I believe personally.
Yeah. It's that muse thing. They talk about the muse, whatever that is for you. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what it is. I almost don't want to know in a way, you know, because I feel the same way when I come up with lyrics that I'm proud of, lyrics, a song that I'm happy with. Wow, that's like, how did I come up with that? And I've even filmed myself writing. There's a song called Small Town. What is it called? Uptown Streets, from our last full length. And I filmed part of that writing session where I came up with like the chorus, and I was just trying to like see if there's a spark that happens. Like what happens when you write a song and you're like, okay, but no, it doesn't look like anything. It's just, you just start playing this thing and then it morphs into like the idea. Rarely do I come up with the exact hook, you know. Hooks usually change for me, you know, once we put the full band on it, or once I get it into another song, I'll tweak, you know, how a chorus would go, you know, like I'll usually write a verse, and you know, what's funny is the verses I usually write stick, like the first verse, the melody, however that song goes, that usually sticks. So whatever it is about verses, I'm good at writing those, but the choruses, I'll almost always write 1, 2, or 3 choruses. And by the time I'm like, okay, that's the chorus. And then the next day, or, you know, that night, I'm like, that's not the chorus, you know, there's something, you know, that happens. So that muse, that spark that happens is a very real thing, but I cannot explain it. I have no idea how, you know, where it comes from, but it's one of those things that is kind of a headspace thing again. Putting yourself in that position. And maybe that's why what Offspring, you know, those Offspring guys are waiting for when they wait 9 years to make a record is they're tweaking those choruses, right? They're like, that's not quite right. I mean, I'm sure they do that, you know, because I do that.
There's also, I think, two kinds of bands, right? I think bands that are just constantly forcing the creativity out because of that work approach. And that's not to say that it's bad or any lesser quality. It's just they just have to keep delivering because that's the way they're inbuilt. Obviously, if you have a bit of success, it allows a bit more freedom. But there are those other bands, I think, that just, like Feldy is another great example with Goldfinger, right? They'll go out and play all the time. But there was, I think, about an 8 or 9 period between records with them. And I think it's just like when the moment's right, then it'll happen. But you can't force it. You know, there's bands that do, and I don't know whether force is the right word, but does that make sense? There's like the blue collar, let's keep this thing rolling, let's keep consistent. And then there are the other bands that just kind of like, well, when it feels like we need to get in a studio, then and only then will we do it.
Yeah, with Goldfinger, it was a spark, a big spark that turned into a flame. And, you know, our management, same management for MXPX, he was like, I think it's time to do a record. And Feldy's like, boom, and literally wrote a record in less than a month.
What was going on situationally that do you think like started that fire? Because it had to be something, right? A combination of things.
Well, probably the pandemic was part of it. We had a bunch of shows booked. I'm sure we were coming back to the UK, you know, and then of course that all went away. And so we started doing the quarantine sessions, which was us playing, you know, a lot of Goldfinger songs on video in our respective places.
Where was Charlie? He looked like he was in a studio. Was he just in like his local space? Because he always looked like he was on like a proper set. You guys were clearly at home, but I was like, where's Charlie going to be next?
Yeah, Charlie actually went to a studio. Yeah, where he went to where we were recording he was recording his parts for the new Goldfinger.
Right on.
So yeah, John Graber and Reese were there with him, the engineers and producers. So anyway, but that was fun. But as far as like the spark and how it happened, I think it happened because of those quarantine videos, because that really, really, I don't know, it just lit a fire under the Goldfinger fans, you know, and they started just craving more and more gold, like, hey, when's the next video? You know, don't stop ever. Eventually, you know, it did stop. And Feldy started working on the new album, started writing, and he sent me like 6 songs that were, they were all fleshed out. All the drums were done. They weren't quite finished as far as like editing. There was a lot of really messed up mix scenarios, like levels, like things were too loud and too quiet, but it was enough to where I could listen and go over, okay, I'm gonna write a bass line for this. There was a couple songs that had bass lines, and I would just write my, I would kind of go along with some of it and then rewrite my own parts. So there was all different sorts of stuff that he would throw, but it happened so quickly, and I was like, okay, I guess I'm also making a record.
How did that opportunity first come up, Mike, to join the band? And was it like, was there any hesitation? Because it's obviously a unique role as somebody who's like the leader of one band to then go and be like a part of another band, rather than, you know, front and center. So what was how did the invitation come about? What was the initial interest, I guess, that made you want to do it? And then getting into that mix, how did you find the, you know, the initial like first phase of either touring or creating whatever was first?
Sure.
I find it really interesting.
Well, it was 2013. I got a call from Feldy and he was like, "Hey, what's up, man? How you doing?" It's been a long time since we talked. Like, we knew each other, you know, we met, way back in, I would say 1996 or seven. We opened for the Sex Pistols. So MXPX, wow, and Goldfinger. So we'll
come back to that.
Yeah. So that's where we met. And so he called me up and he's like, "Oh, we're going to Australia. I need a bass player. Would you be down?" Australia, Goldfinger. It was with the tour was with Real Big Fish as well. Real Big Fish, Zebrahead. Or do you call it Zebrahead?
All the homies, all my other tour mates. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I'm like, all right. You know, so I ended up doing it, you know, in 2013, it was before MXPX was 2014 was when MXPX sort of like really picked up our touring again. But at that point we had played like maybe one or two shows a year for a couple of years. And I was doing my band. I had just finished up doing my band Tumble Down. We didn't officially break up. We just kind of went on hiatus. So all these things were sort of like, oh, I guess I don't really have much going on. I just started this podcast, but that wasn't really much. So yeah, it worked out. We went to Australia. Aaron played guitar as well. Aaron from Real Big Fish, Aaron Barrett, played guitar for Goldfinger.
For the full set every night.
Full set every night.
Wow.
And so it was like a little bit of, it was kind of like what MXPX had started doing during those years when Tom and Yuri couldn't make shows.
Supergroup style, punk rock supergroup
style. Yeah. I had friends come out. I had Chris Rowe and Chris from Good Charlotte came out, you know, like, so I was like, I get it. Okay. I'll do it. This will be fun. This will be low stress. I can pay some bills and let's see how it goes. So that started, and every now and then they would call me up and it was just like a show by show basis, like a sort of like, oh, let's do New York. And I got to tour with Charlie and Darren in New York and Florida. We did a run where it was all those guys and me on bass. So like they're not the original, because there's been a lot of different guys in the band, but they were sort of the original long form Goldfinger.
The classic and, lineup.
Yeah, the classic. Yeah, you know, it was fun to watch Darren and Charlie go at it in the van. Like, I was like the little kid in the back seat of the car, and they're like the parents going,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, John would show up at the show for sound check and everything, you know, their dynamic. And it was a lot of fun, I'll say, but it was very stressful.
It's a unique pressure cooker of personalities, and I adore Charlie. I want to listen to your podcast episodes with him, but when I did a chat with him, I just got such a great insight into his mind, his life. And I didn't know he was going to be rejoining the band for that tour that he did, the first one, the Fireball tour that you guys did. Mm-hmm. So I'm there the first night, I'm watching golfing, and I'm like, oh shit, Charlie's back in the band. And I spoke to both Charlie and John about, you know, respectively each other, and it was just really cool to see them like healing those old wounds and, you know, reconnecting and yeah, like just putting that past behind and moving forward. It's a unique band, isn't it?
Yeah, Charlie's been great. Charlie's, you know, he's a unique character. He's very opinionated. He'll walk into the show and be like, "All right, where's the sound guy? Where's the light guy? Come over here," and he'll be like, "Let's talk to you." Blah blah blah. We usually have our own sound guy, but sometimes we don't with Goldfinger, actually. But it's fun and it's interesting to learn how different band people react in their respective situations. Yeah. And even like, I'll spill a little tea, Charlie, especially, but even all the Goldfinger guys, they will shower before the show. Charlie, especially, he'll shower right before we go on stage. And I'm like, "Wait, what? Wait, aren't you just going to go out there and sweat?" And he's like, "Yeah, but you know, I just got to get get into it. I'm like, okay, I get that. That's cool. All right. But I had never like thought of doing that. But now, honestly, like now, because of Charlie, if I feel like, you know, you get like nervous sometimes, or like if you're like going to fly somewhere, like a long flight to Australia or something, you kind of have that nervous energy. I'll take a shower and then I'll head to the, you know, usually you do take a shower and head to the airport, but like I'll even take a shower and do a show, you know, that kind of thing.
It's a reset, isn't it?
That's because of Charlie. It is a reset. It is a reset. So, not all his ideas are dumb.
it's interesting as well. I didn't know that you drank, because obviously I know, you know, Charlie and John have been sober for forever. And, you know, I've been on tours and stuff many times, particularly with John, and know that it's, you know, it's a sober operation. So I just presumed that you didn't drink either. And then I listened to a couple of podcasts that you'd done, and you're talking about having a beer and stuff. And I was like, oh, man, we could have had a drink on the tour and stuff. But yeah.
Is it? We did have some Fireball at once, I thought. But
did we?
Probably didn't make the connection.
Oh, man, with those Fireball shots, I tried to erase them. Bearing in mind, Fireball used to sponsor my podcast, and I've done 5 Fireball tours. So me and Fireball have a very complicated relationship.
Yeah, I bet.
Like love, hate.
Well, it's funny because when I started with Goldfinger, there was no alcohol in the dressing room.
That's kind of what I thought, yeah.
Yeah, and so I was like, okay, it's because John's sober, and you know, and then you know, Charlie's sober, and but Darren would have a beer, so me and Darren would like go to the other dressing room and like hang out with the other bands and have a beer. And then after a while, after I got in the band for a while, I was like, I think it's okay, you know, now that I know John, he's like, he's around people that drink all the time, he's around people that smoke cigarettes and weed and whatever it is, he just doesn't do it himself. It's like, okay, I think we probably can get away with putting some beer in the fridge or whatever. He's not going to freak out. And I think it's just something that you get used to, like a certain way. Oh, no alcohol in the dressing room, and nobody ever says anything. And then all Mike Herrera shows up, and now there's beer and whiskey and vodka and tequila and whatever else. And, you know, there's my section of the dressing room over there. And then, you know, the sober section. But if there was an issue, like if John was like, hey, it really freaks me out to see all this alcohol, I just might grab it and start drinking it, you know, then I would be respectful, you know, and say, okay, no problem. I'll put all that alcohol in my backpack. No worries.
It's just about the line, isn't it? And as you say, like trust and
yeah.
And you know, if it's going to be cool, then yeah. Then
it is cool. It's not about, honestly, it's not about alcohol. I mean, he makes a decision. I make a decision, and give or take, we don't need alcohol, but at the same time, I don't think we also need to have it in a whole nother room, because John's been sober for a long time. I think
he was 18, right?
Drink. Yeah. He doesn't want a drink at this point. I don't think so, but yeah, everybody's a little different. So it's important to feel that line out, figure it out. So it took me a couple of years to do it, but
what's it like now being in the band? Does it feed back into MXPX in any way creatively, or is that just kind of like almost your holiday job? Like,
well, no, everything feeds into everything a little bit, I think. Just one, the fact that, you know, when I'm on stage with Goldfinger, we'll have MXPX fans in the audience being like, oh, it's Mike. Hey, you know, like specifically because they're MXPX fans, they want to say hi. And, you know, that happens. I don't know if it's happened as much with the other way around, but, you know, we haven't, but it probably has happened. But it's funny because when I'm doing Goldfinger shows, it is more relaxing. It is less stressful. Like what I have to do during the day is much less than what I have to do when MXPX is playing. And it's probably a sense of responsibility. I do realize the irony in that, but MXPX, I got more that I have to do. I'm working on stuff during the day. We've got, you know, we have sound checks for Goldfinger as well, but you know, and the longer I'm in the band, I have more responsibility with Goldfinger, but I still don't feel the stress that I feel with MXPX. I think it's just inherent to the fact that I'm the lead guy for MXPX. And so if something doesn't happen, it's all me. So like if something doesn't happen with Goldfinger, I know that I'm probably going to get paid at the end of the day, and don't worry about it. We're good.
I definitely think there's a certain pressure that comes with being the front man in every band, you know, because you are, for all intents and purposes, like you're the mouthpiece, you're the focal point. It's kind of eyes mm-hmm. on you, right? And it's up to yeah. you to be the captain, to set the tone. You know, it's a shared responsibility, of course, but I do think with every band, unless it's maybe like a two-piece and it's dueling vocalists or something like that, you know, but I think with almost every band, there's kind of like, you know, an added, even if it's only a little bit, an added pressure being the yeah. face.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is when John comes in, he gets in, I don't know, like a mindset.
He's an intense dude.
Yeah, he's intense. And I do that right at the end, you know, like right when we're about to go on stage, you know, I'll be breathing, I'll do some push-ups, just get the blood pumping. That's for Goldfinger, you know, just make sure physically I'm really dialed in. But with MXPX, I wouldn't say that I'm just like John or whatever, but like I have a certain intensity that I dial up, and mentally I'm much more in my head and I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking about this. And it's like, that's when I feel good. I mean, that's I want to, you know, get ramped up and amped up, and I want to treat this show as something that's, you know, I'm putting everything I have into this show. I'm going to go out there. I'm ready. You know, I'm not going to all of a sudden pull a hammy because I've stretched, you know, things like that. You know, and that's what John does. He does most of that in the hotel, and then he'll show up, and, you know, I've watched a lot of front men do that, front women. Mike Ness is a perfect example. He, Social Distortion, he'll be backstage shadow boxing. He's really into like that old timey look, you know.
Yeah,
he never breaks
character. Chicago gangster from the Prohibition era, that dude.
Yes, yes. So he gets amped up, man, where he's just like punching the air, but he sees something, you know, he's in his mind, he's doing something more than what you see. And then he goes out there because he's a mellow dude, kind of like me. Like I was talking about my early interviews when I was just, hey guys, how's it going? Like that's Mike Ness. He's a very mellow guy. But when he's out there on stage, he's in the zone. He doesn't even need a vocal monitor, really. Like he gets in his own, he hears his own head voice is what they call it. If you put earplugs in, you can kind of hear your head vibrating. And so, yeah, he's like a different person on stage in a cool way. Yeah.
I love him. I've interviewed him a couple of times and I've seen that transformation because I've spoken to him like an hour or two before the show. And he's like, hey, man, how's it going? Like very soft, yeah. Very softly spoken, almost, dare I say this, almost effeminate. And I know that might sound strange to some people because he's like the sort of textbook definition of masculinity and macho tough guy stuff. But he's so chill. It's almost like there's a sense. Well, there's clearly a sensitive soul there because he's an amazing songwriter. But there's a soft side to that guy. And yeah, then he gets on stage and it's like true grit. And it is. It's like a total flip.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I haven't interviewed Mike. You know, he's produced he produced an MXPX song for us back in the day. And of course, we've seen him on tour and Warped Tour and stuff. We've opened for him on Social D shows. But the one thing I would love to ask him would be, was he a Grease fan? Did he watch the movie Grease as a kid? One, because of the style, the 50s greaser style that he's got, hot rods, pinup girls.
Of course.
Fights, fist fights, but also
flick blades, all of that stuff. Yeah.
Also, Grease is very—it's like a theatrical play in a way, where you know you have somebody like who's the main guy in Grease? Who's it?
Danny Zuko.
Danny Zuko. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, he's dancing and he's very effeminate in a lot of times, and they're singing songs like from theater class, you know, kind of style. And so, like, there is a fake macho-ness to it, but and there's also like an effeminateness to that movie Grease, which I'm a huge fan of as well. So I'm basically saying the same thing about me. But I wonder if that had any effect on him. Probably not.
You got to ask him if you ever
what he is. I mean, man, as a punk fan, punk rock fan that watched Another State of Mind, you know, the documentary growing up, of Social D in the back of the van.
Who is it? Them and Youth Brigade. Who's the other band?
Youth Brigade was the other band. And, you know, it was very similar to like how like Black Flag was touring. You know, they'd be in the back of this like box truck, you know, like no windows.
Get in the van, go. Yeah.
Yeah. Just get in there, go for it. You know, all these atrocious living situations out on tour. You know, when we were on tour, there was always something happening. You know, our first tour, the first weekend, our van broke down in Flagstaff, Arizona. It was actually in the mountains of Colorado. And we kind of like eked our way down into the Flagstaff area to get it fixed. But it was overheating every 15 minutes. We'd pull over, pour the water in, wait for it to cool down, go again. It would heat up in about 10 miles, you know, a few miles down the road, 10 minutes later, it'd start heating up and we'd slow down. And it was like a popcorn popper. And we're like, what is going on? And we're just kids at the time. This is 1995, our very first tour. So like, these are the experiences we're having. And we started listening to you know, Get in the Van by Henry Rollins. And I would read the book, but we'd listen to it on CD in our van. And that, all those experiences made our experiences seem like nothing. Like it was not a big deal. Like nobody's pulling a knife on us. We're in the mountains. Maybe a wolf or a coyote might come and attack us. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is I feel like that kind of helped normalize shitty situations out on tour.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I've been chatting to a few of that sort of first wave of punkers over the last few weeks, and sometimes in bands that would go on to be part of other movements. Like I was chatting to Sean from White Zombie, and Keith Morris from Circle Jerks and Black Flag, and all of those kind of like DIY first wave of punk bands, and they kind of without fail, they would all say, as bad as it was on the road, being on tour was like a glamorous holiday to them because their home situation was so bad. You know, whether they're in the Lower East Side in New York, or they're living in absolute shitholes in Hollywood, or where or Hermosa Beach, wherever it was, a lot of them would say that actually, however bad tour was, it was almost a welcome break from our shitty apartment back home. That's kind of how rough and bleak punk was to begin with. You know, it wasn't a career for anybody. It wasn't any way of making money or, you know, being successful. It was literally you did it for the love and you just wanted to get out there and play shows, even if you were sleeping in the worst places and playing to three people. And so to have all of that come before you, I guess, must have been, as you say, like validation and inspiration. Like, yeah, however bad this seems, they had it worse. Let's get out there and do this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, is like, we were very naive, very naive. So we got signed in 1994 after being a band for 2 years. 1992 was when we started. And
how old were you when you got signed, Mike?
I was 17 years old, 17. So I had to have my parents sign for us. Didn't get a lawyer, should have. Bad, big mistake. But, you know, all those mistakes, those business, early business mistakes have led us to here, you know, so it's, you know, you can't really knock it. But yeah, I mean, we were so naive. We thought, yeah, if we just go on tour, this is what we do now. You know, like I wasn't even thinking career. So I think that's how naive we were, is I was thinking about nothing but I want to do this. I don't care about anything else. I'm not going to plan for the future. I don't ever want to go to college. I wouldn't know first thing about what I would do if I didn't do this, except for back to the dishwashing, back to landscaping, back to all the menial jobs that I did before touring. And it was only a few years. It was while I was in high school, but we're so naive that we just assumed that when we go on tour, we're just going to continue to do it. And that's exactly what happened. We continued to do it. We started out we started out touring with this band Blender Head. It was their tour, but I would say it was a damn near co-headliner, because both of our bands weren't that well known, and I would say we were just becoming a little bit more well known. But it was their tour, so we went and we played to like 15 people in Beloit, Wisconsin. That was our smallest show, but the shows were actually pretty good. We had like 50 people, 80 people, 100 people at a few shows. And it was, back in those days, DIY promoters. So it'd be some kid, some teenage kid or early 20s guys, like they partner with their friends, their college buddies, to bring out a couple bands, and they would just find a venue or pizza shop or whatever. It was like, yeah, you know, community centers, churches, like the whole, not everything. And everybody was naive back then, right? Because it was the punk scene. It wasn't like U2, you know, it wasn't like we were in that world of arenas. And
the world you were in was really just formulating, wasn't it? There'd been no precedent. Yeah. It was, they were making it up on the spot as they went along, because there'd been no precursor to it. It was all brand new.
It was,
and as you say, the promoters and the agents and the managers and the record labels, they were all basically punk kids as well, weren't they? They were like, well, I can't play an instrument, but I can start a label, so let's do that and let's sign the bands, or let's book the bands to play the shows.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we got signed to Tooth and Nail Records, and they were all kid, you know, young adults in their 20s or early 20s, but to us they seemed like adults because we were kids. And like promoters, we always had a good relationship with Greenland, they're called Greenland, up in Montreal. They did Snow Jam, or they did these festivals that we ended up doing many years ago.
The things that were like the precursor to Warped Tour kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Face to Face would do it. Satanic Surfers, No Use for a Name. So like, it was all that style of music, skate punk and snowboarding style of music. And we had a blast up there, and we saw them as our superiors, because they were adults and we were kids, but still they were probably in their early 20s at the time. And Padge and Nancy, by the way, they're probably not listening, but you know, shout out to them, anybody that's listening that knows them, because they did a lot of cool things for the punk scene in the early years. And as Warped Tour got going, I would see them at the Warped Tours, and they would do like co-producing or co-promoting or whatever for that kind of stuff. So it was cool to still see them. So yeah, I mean, it's funny because like, I don't remember most of those people. There's been so many of those types of people throughout the career and throughout my life. And you just, it's a blur, you know, and here we are in 2021 and things have changed so much since then. Blood Sausage. That's what I remember from that tour. Do you know what Blood Sausage is?
The food. Yeah.
So we showed up in Montreal and
like this black guy, pudding you're talking about. Would that be the same? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So our driver shows up in this old van, and it's like, there's no insulation. It's just a metal van, a work van. And we're just in the back, and he's driving us around, and his band is called Blood Sausage. I can't remember the guy's name, but like that stuck in our brain because we're like, what's blood sausage? And of course, you know, he's telling us all about it. And we didn't know anything back in those days. You know, we had been to Japan once and we had been to Germany once and Canada a few times. And so like, it was just, we're just starting to get out into the world and learn about foods. Like we didn't know what Thai food was back then. We didn't learn about Thai food until our Life in General album in 1996. So, I mean, it's just crazy how you can go through life, not know about something that is almost like an everyday kind of thing that you should know. I wouldn't say blood sausage is something that
travel is the key to all of it, right? Travel is just the absolute, I think, meaning of life. It broadens your horizons. It shifts your perspective. It deepens your appreciation. It, you know, it teaches you about empathy and understanding and everything. Like, I think the more traveled you are, I think ultimately the richer of mind and heart and soul you are.
Yeah, traveling has changed my life, my perspective, my ideas about life so much and for the better. So yeah, I strongly agree. I'm on the travel train and it's tiring too. I mean,
but also that is also educational. You know, I think like when you go through struggle, and it is a struggle being on tour and all those, you know, hours you put in to get from A to B to play that show. The show's like obviously the greatest thing ever. Every day that show is the highlight of the day. It's all the bullshit that goes into getting there and putting it on that becomes weary, right? You know, whether it's the constant sound checks or, as you say, like the late night long drives or the flights, the jet lag, all of that stuff. That's what grinds you down. The shows is what, you know, that's why you do it. That's why you're there. But in all those miles that you cover, that's where, you know, characters are formed, aren't they? In the quests, in the adventures.
Absolutely. If a perfect example would be the first two albums from MXPX are pre-tour, and our third album, Life in General, is after tour, after our first tour. And everything, in my opinion, everything after Life in General and on has a different perspective, has a much better sound, even, you know, if you just break it down to the songwriting and the actual playing of the songs, we just got so much better. You know, we've been ground down not only by the world, by touring, by meeting all these people along the way, some of which were very rude. and then
they're out there in force.
They are. They're still out there. fuck them. We don't need them. And then, you know, having a producer like Steve Kravac on Life in General, he really taught us how to put your ideas onto tape. And before that, I'd never really realized, okay, what you convey through this microphone is going to translate onto the tape. And yeah, you can mix things and change things and but ultimately the performance is going to be the essence of everything, what people get from the song. And so another reason why I feel like there's definitely raw emotion on those first albums and people love those styles and stuff. Nothing wrong with it. I like it too. Sure.
Let me just quickly say this, Mike, you're being quite hard on yourself because teenage politics, right? If you listen to say an early NoFX record, it's garbage, you know, and they're my favorite punk band. I adore NoFX. But if you listen to like Liberal Animation, that shit's garbage. Whereas, you know, you're 16 years old, right? Is teenage politics when you were 16?
By then I was probably 18.
Even then, those songs, you might not think that they sound that mature and sophisticated, but those songs structurally and lyrically, from a fucking 18-year-old kid's mind, that's pretty impressive. They hold up. The first record is a little more raw and there's a naive charm there. But that second album, I think, stands up. And to have been that young and to be crafting songs like that at that age is quite a thing, because there's so many other bands that it took them three or four albums to actually get to a point. Even Green Day, you look at some of their early stuff. Like, I think a lot of bands take a while to find their voice. Seems like yours was always there.
I guess I just needed to craft it. I mean, thank you. That's really kind. You know, for me, it's always about iteration. You know, the more I do something, the more I either realize, okay, this is good, let's keep doing it, it gets better. Or I'll realize, okay, I need to change something. And I can only figure that out by doing it and by failing. You know, it's a lot, you know, they say when you play a live show, when you go up to perform, or if you're going to like, if you don't perform, if you're just in the audience, you know, if you get up on stage, you know, they say that,
Do you live next to a racetrack, by the way?
It's just so loud. I have a main. Yeah, it's so loud. I'm right next to the window. It keeps bugging me.
It's all good my end, as long as you're cool. Yeah, you're talking about when people get on stage. You're making an analogy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, when people get on stage, they don't necessarily do exactly what they think they're doing. You know, it's only when they look at what they've done, like on a video or something, like, oh, that, and then they can change things, they can tweak. And I think you don't necessarily like what I was, the point I was trying to make is if I don't look at myself, I'll eventually figure it out. It's just going to take a lot of those shows, a lot of those failing to get there. And a lot of people, a lot of professionals like comedians and people that do speeches, they'll do these speeches over and over and over so that when they get up there, they're not failing. So they'll do all that work. And the problem is for me, it's like, it's so hard to do the actual show until I'm in that moment. It's like if you're in rehearsal.
Well, you can rehearse all you want, but yeah, once you're on stage hard. And it's live, all bets are off.
The more you rehearse, the better, because it gets your muscle memory going so that when you are in those moments and you have all the distraction of the cars driving by, for me, like I should be more focused and not let that bother me. So next time I will be better at that. That's all I'm saying is just, it takes me so many times. It takes a lot of people so many times, but probably, maybe I'm being hard on myself, but yeah, it takes me a lot. So if you see me doing something really good, just know I've practiced a lot to get there. And most people you see, Steve Caballero, a friend of mine that is a pro skater, he is huge on this, where he says, people ask me all the time, you know, oh, I wish I had your talent. He's like, it's not talent. I'm bailing constantly. I'm practicing all the time. I've broken both my legs. Like, the work is hard, and that's what gets me where I am. So everybody, you know, there's no really easy way to get through things. Use tools to make your work good, but I feel like don't try to cut corners just to cut corners.
I wholeheartedly agree with all of that. And the other thing is, if you are an overnight sensation and you get like super successful out of nowhere and you haven't paid your dues and put in the groundwork, you might have the opportunity to play to the world in whatever craft it is you do, but you might blow that opportunity because you haven't trained and prepared for it. And there's been many instances of that, I think. Perhaps not so much now, because you very rarely nowadays get like these overnight sensations. But yeah, I think if you're in the opportunity where the spotlights are on, but you haven't done all those years of groundwork and honing the craft, then you're either going to buckle under the pressure or you're not going to live up to the expectation. It's all in the prep. 100%, I agree with that. Like when I used to work on Kerrang Radio as a kid, like I was 24, my first job in this industry was hosting the evening show on Kerrang, which at that point was on FM and DAB, and it had like a million listeners a week or something mad. And my first gig was like 7 till 10 on that. And what I would do is every night after the show, I'd go home, not every night because I'd be out partying some nights, but at least every other night, I would go home and listen to the show I'd just done on the website on replay and analyze my links and think, how could I be doing better? What could I change? What could I stop? What could I take out? What could I add? And I would do that week in, week out for the entire 3.5 years I worked there, constantly trying to evolve and progress and grow as a presenter. And yeah, as you say, it's like, oh, look at this guy. He's so talented. He's so lucky. It's like, well, it's funny, isn't it? Because it's like the harder you work, the luckier you get, as the old phrase goes.
That's brilliant. That's true. I mean, straight up.
Dude, I want to ask you a couple of things before I let you go. Have you got some time?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah. And I definitely want to do another one of these with you, because I feel like we could talk about so much more for hours, and it's been great, as I knew it would. Sex Pistols, you opened up for them in 2007. Was that an experience worth recalling? Was it eventful? Was it all four? Was it the original lineup?
It was 97, actually, but yeah.
Even better. So they were even more in their prime.
Yeah, that was the tour. They came back and they did a world tour, and it was the original lineup, and well, not the original lineup, I guess.
Was Glenn in the band?
Sid wasn't there.
Was Glenn Matlock on bass?
I guess Glenn was there, yeah.
Because Glenn was the original bassist. He left and then Sid replaced him. So Sid wasn't actually on Nevermind the Bollocks. Funny. He came in after, which is funny because everybody thinks of the Sex Pistols and they think of Johnny and Sid. But yeah, so it would have been the original Nevermind the Bollocks lineup with Glenn, Paul Cook, Steve Jones, and Johnny Rotten.
That makes sense. Yeah, probably. I assume so. I didn't actually honestly think of that when we were playing with them. We were just like, oh my God, like, because we were doing Bumper Shoot and they were playing their show at Bumper Shoot, but it was just their show at basically it's like an open air arena. And the opening band was Goldfinger, and then Stabbing Westward was the support act, and then Sex Pistols. Well, Stabbing Westward, the singer got sick, and so they canceled. And we got a call that day, the day of the show, and we're like, hey, do you want to open for the Sex Pistols? We're like, yeah, we'll be right over. Hold on.
Is that up there in one of the top five easy, like, best phone calls of your life? Because that has to be, like, I mean, for me, number one, Sex Pistols are the greatest punk band of all time because they were just, like, the catalyst for all of it.
Absolutely.
That's, like, a dream scenario as a phone call gets, right?
Yes. I mean, we couldn't even believe it, but we're like, absolutely. So we go over and we're opening, and Goldfinger moves up to the support slot. And at the time I played with my fingers, I played bass with my fingers, and we're on our last song. Everything went fine. People, definitely some of the punks, some of the old school punks didn't like us. They're like, throwing stuff. We expected that. That happened back in those days a lot more than you could even imagine. People don't realize how nice crowds are these days.
Well, we had spitting as the thing in England, was people gobbing.
Oh yeah. I've been spit on in Europe, in England. Yes. Not like every night, but there's been a few nights where it's like, oh my God, I was going to punch that guy. And then they're like, what? We like you. Like,
it's a sign of appreciation. Like,
oh, man. They always say that at the end. Yeah.
So you're getting all kinds of shit hurled at you. But it's going over okay.
But it's going pretty good. Yeah, it's going good. And we're on the last song, punk rock show. I break a string. And I'm like, fuck. Okay, so I start playing just the other strings. There's three more. And so I'm playing the other strings. My other string breaks. So my low E breaks. And then my A string breaks. So all I have are the high strings, the high ones. And so I had to do like an octave kind of thing and try to figure it out. But it was towards the end of the song at that point. And I look over and our roadie, you know, is just like, you don't have another bass. That's it. You know, sorry. But we finished the set. It was fine. And it was chaos. And then we went backstage. Everything was cool. We watched Goldfinger play, and Goldfinger came up. And right before they came up, the radio DJ goes, all right, stop throwing all that shit, or whatever he says, right? Don't be throwing anything. And so when Goldfinger comes up, immediately everybody just starts pelting them with cans and trash. And Feldy stops the crowd and goes, hold on. And he goes, where's that DJ guy? Where's the DJ? Come on out here, motherfucker. The guy walks up, he's still side stage. He walks up and he's like, all right, you told them exactly what not to do. Now for the next 1 minute, you guys are all free to throw whatever you want on stage at this guy. And they did it. And the whole fucking crowd just pelts this radio DJ with cans, spit, beer, soda, hot dogs. It was terrible. And
assumedly, John had him right on the fucking palm of his hands then, and the crowd were on board because they were like, we like this guy. Did it go down like that?
Yeah, it was great. It went over great. The Sex Pistols were pissed. They were so mad. They were so mad because the stage was just covered in shit. And I'm pretty sure. So they were so mad. They kicked everybody out of the backstage, including MXPX and Goldfinger. And Goldfinger was on the tour with Sex Pistols. So, I mean, they were supposed to be playing like the other shows. But Goldfinger was so mad that Darren went into the Sex Pistols dressing room and trashed it, because the Sex Pistols hadn't shown up yet. They're at the hotel. They're in a van. They show up at the van, you know, backstage right before they go on stage. Darren goes in and starts trashing the Sex Pistols dressing room. And then he's like, fine, all right, let's go. And then they kick everybody and we all leave, but everything's trashed. And the Sex Pistols show up. They're pissed. They kick, you know, they kick Goldfinger off the tour. And Darren's like, F you, blah, 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 all this stuff. And then a couple weeks later, they get a call. All right, you're back on the tour. So they got back on the tour. I don't know what happened, but that was when we first, you know, I first met Feldy and Darren and all the Goldfinger guys. Didn't get to meet Sex Pistols that day, unfortunately.
Oh, man. Well, at least you got to play with them. That's few people can say that. And you're never going to forget that first meeting with Feldy, and then to end up in a band with him all these years later after that is, I mean, that's just the beautiful nature of this, you know, very complicated and sometimes challenging, but ultimately beautiful and rewarding little industry and lane that we're in. It's a crazy business, isn't it? The business of show, but I wouldn't be anywhere else.
For so many years, the Sex Pistols story was kind of one of the, you know, it was like the only cool thing that happened to us. So like if somebody would ask, so what's the craziest thing that, you know, the coolest thing that's ever happened to you, you know, as a band? And I'd say, oh, when we got to open for Sex Pistols. So many, many other cool things and crazy things have happened. But for a long time, that was the go-to. It's kind of fun to bring it up again, but.
It's Sex Pistols for me are number one. As I said, I had Johnny on the show a few years back. He was my 10th guest. Episode 10 was with John Lydon, and he was amazing. I was terrified going into it, and I very rarely get nervous about interviews because I've just almost at this stage interviewed everybody that I'd want to. But he was kind of one of the last figures in my life that I've always been inspired by and wanted to sit down with, and he couldn't have been sweeter, man. He was an absolute, just a true sweetheart and a true gentleman, and you know, spiky and unpredictable that you'd want, but absolute gold to me. I just want to finish by saying, I was going to get into it a bit more, but we'll maybe leave a more in-depth discussion of it for another time. But some of the stuff that you raised with Ben Weasel and with Blagg, and I've had Blagg on my show and I adore Blagg. I've never spoken to Ben, but after hearing your chat with him, I really want to. But those two, obviously, you know, they're these kind of like problematic quote unquote figures that a lot of people like to write off and say, you know, they're bad guys, whatever. But two of the smartest, most intelligent, articulate, well-spoken, just like super interesting guys that have got so much of value and such great insights to shed. That they were two of my favorite podcasts that I've ever heard, man. I just wanted to say great job with them. I know probably they're, you know, good friends of yours, and you weren't going in there to like try and, you know, uncover these meaty topics, but right, boy did you get there. Amazing conversation.
Thank you. Yeah, those guys are great. And that's the thing, is like, you can talk to anybody for long enough and they're going to talk about things they love. They're going to, you know, they're going to get into who they are. And so, you know, it's funny. I'm a huge fan of Screeching Weasel. Like they were definitely, you know, if I had, you know, the Descendants were my biggest influence, you know, growing up, but I would say Screeching Weasel could be maybe the second, you know, even above, you know, all the big punk bands like the Clash and, you know, Sex Pistols and, you know, things like that. But Ramones, you know, of course I love all those bands, but yeah, the Screeching Weasel, I grew up listening to that stuff all the time. And I definitely hear that influence in my songwriting and in definitely a lot of the way I put chords together to influence. But I never knew anything about him. You know, I back in the days, you know, like I didn't know anything about Milo or Bill Stevenson from the Descendants or, you know, Ben Weasel from Screeching Weasel. Like all these guys, like they were mysteries to me. You know, I didn't know. I was a fan of the Queers too, you know, growing up, and we
love that band.
Queers. and their crowd hated us. But years later, everything's fine. You know, it's like, it's just funny that you can grow up listening to bands, know nothing about them, and end up having these conversations where I'm just curious to know how they did it. How are they so smart at such a young age? Like somebody like Ben Weasel, listening to his lyrics at, you were saying that about my lyrics. I feel like that about Ben Weasel, about, you know, he was talking about how it doesn't matter if you're gay or if you're this or that, like he was just so open with all those things.
Well, that's the great irony of why the cancel culture brigade going after them is so absurd, you know, isn't it? It's because people like him were the first proponents of equality and treating everybody with respect, no matter what their skin tone or body parts or any of that. And then obviously now we're in this world where you put one foot wrong and it's like, cancelled. And it's like, what? What about all this good work that I've done for like two decades before you were even born?
No, it's funny. Like we've MXPX has played with Screech Weasel a couple of times.
It's the last time I saw you.
Years.
London Forum. In London. I was at that show. Yeah, man.
That's great. So we did a show with them in BC, Canada, in Vancouver. Yeah, Vancouver. And the Commodore Theater. And that show, well, all the shows we've done with them have been great. But that show in particular, he got in a big fight with an audience member. And I don't know what it was. It had something to do with like women, feminine, something or other. And he was just like not backing down. He was like during the show, in their face, you know, they're in the crowd and they're just talking. And he's like yelling and he's just like ripping them a new asshole, just going off like this and that and that. And I'm like, kind of, you know, makes sense. It's like, that's an adversarial kind of thing that it's almost like a treat in a way, if you can get Ben Weasel to yell at you. But that used to happen, I think, at those shows much more. Like that was like an almost nightly thing where like a Black Flag show, somebody would throw a punch and the whole band would jump into the mix and Henry Rollins was in there, you know, just listening to him, his writings and stuff like that. And then to witness that, like, I don't know, I felt like I'm like, okay, I'm finally witnessing something in the flesh, you know, some little
You're part
piece
of punk rock history right there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just one little tiff or whatever with these two people. But there's just, I don't often make those connections personally, say like, think about when I was 16 years old, just about to start MXPX, listening to Screeching Weasel, Boogada 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 on a tape in the truck going to work. Me and my buddy, Rich, we worked together. We did these like landscaping jobs. We'd dig ditches. We'd go clean up rental houses and clean up the yards. So like that was sort of like my teenage kind of punk rock childhood where I was just getting a lesson in life from Ben Weasel, from Joe Queer. I would even listen to NoFX back then. Rancid was not quite there. I think Op Ivy was around. Rancid was just getting going. But as soon as Rancid started, I was a fan. Like I was a fan of their first album right when it came out. So like I was paying attention for sure. I heard No Use for a Name on a snowboard video or something like that. So
yeah.
Like I discovered a lot of these bands just the same way that any other kid would discover them. It was just like literally right when I was getting into punk rock myself.
So. And getting signed and going out on tour with, you know, Bad Religion and
yep.
Amazing, man. Yeah. I would say anybody who's interested in checking out your podcast, for me, that Ben Weasel episode would just be the best place to start because it's a 2-hour just epic dissection of so many relevant and interesting and insightful topics. And you're a natural, man. You're a total natural at hosting. I often think it's like when a musician, I imagine, hears perhaps an actor starting a band, right? Like, oh, okay. Yeah, go on. I'm a bit like that because certain musicians, I've heard them do podcasts and I'm like, okay. But yours is amazing. You're a total natural. And I'm a new fan of your show. I'd always been aware of it, but I don't listen to many podcasts because I'm always busy you know, doing my own.
Yeah,
but I'm definitely going to be listening to yours a lot more regularly now. You've done 350 odd episodes, but there's only up to back to like 250 available. Are the rest like hidden away on the MXPX website or somewhere else? What's the deal?
That's a good question. That they should be available in the RSS feed. I think it's just an Apple thing, or like the apps only keep a certain amount. So go to mxpeaks.com/podcast, and there should be a few different options of where you can listen. But the main feed, like where I actually upload it to, you should be able to find it there.
Amazing. And yeah, the recent record, Quarantine Star, that's out. Is there a new album on the way? You said you just sort of been writing some songs. Is there a new record this year? What's going on?
Working on new songs all the time. We have a new song. When's this going to air, by the way?
I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know. Maybe May, June. It'll be like okay. Nearer summertime. It'll be a while.
Okay, cool. So we have a new song out called Can't Keep Waiting, the one I was talking about earlier. That's out everywhere. New album, I don't know. I don't know yet. I'm definitely writing songs, but we're going to keep putting out songs, and then eventually we'll put out an album as well, I'm sure. But
amazing.
No actual plans. We're going to keep doing our Between This World and the Next shows, live on the internet. We're going to start switching it up even more. So each set, of course, is different, but we've got some ideas under our sleeves. Somewhere up our sleeves?
Somewhere in the sleeve. And Goldfinger have got some new music coming as well, which sounds very exciting. Dude, I've really enjoyed this. I hope you have too. And it was nice all these years later to finally, you know, converse for longer than 5 minutes in a stairwell backstage somewhere. And mind you, I do hope we can do that again soon too.
Definitely. Thanks so much for having me, Matt. Appreciate it.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.